as a military weapon.
Blog Talk Radio.
From everyday public. Kopkoff spent time going over details of the victims' lives from the 9 families he represents. He said the case has a lot to do with greed from the gun companies and added Remington used to be a responsible company until they were sold to a private firm. Britain's Prince Andrew has reportedly agreed to a settlement in a sexual abuse lawsuit. Liz Warner has more.
A Manhattan court filing revealing that Virginia Giuffre's lawsuit accusing Britain's Prince Andrew of sexual assault while she was under the control of Jeffrey Epstein is being settled out of court. The prince has reportedly agreed to pay an undisclosed sum to Giuffre, and he will also make a substantial donation to her charity in support of victims' rights. Terms of the deal are being kept under wraps, and this comes just weeks before the prince was expected to be questioned by Giuffre's lawyers under oath.
A funeral will be held on Thursday for a man fatally shot by police during a raid earlier this month in Minnesota. Amir Locke was asleep on a couch in downtown Minneapolis when authorities conducted a no-knock warrant, and he was shot after he was allegedly seen holding a gun. Police were not searching for Locke, and he was not named in any of the warrants. An accused Navy spy is pleading guilty to a single conspiracy charge. Former U.S. Navy nuclear engineer Jonathan Toby and his wife Diana were arrested back in October for allegedly selling secrets about a nuclear submarine in the U.S. Navy nuclear operations. It's unclear if his wife is accepting the plea. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
This is Nathan Mum and Mike Roday from Tech Time with Nathan Mum. Hey, Mike, it's been a couple weeks now, and we're on Kixie and on KKNW. What do you think about this great relationship?
I think it's fantastic.
It is. You know what? I can't believe the excitement that we've gathered with our Tech Time radio show. We're so excited to be broadcasting it out all over everywhere. And, of course, you can still always listen to it on KKNW 1150 Saturdays from 4 to 6 p.m. and on Thursdays from 6 to 7 a.m. Don't miss out on the best technology news without having to geek out.
I think it's fantastic.
And let's go ahead and take a look now to alternative talk weather outlook for Tuesday. Well, we'll see mostly cloudy skies with a few sun breaks here and there. High temperatures around 48, 49 degrees. We'll also have a little bit of wind out of the west turning to south to southwest by the afternoon at 6 to 10 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a 20% chance of showers. Low temperatures dropping a few degrees down to about 43. For Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies with a light chance of showers to start the morning off, moving to partly cloudy skies by the afternoon. High temperatures around 48. Partly cloudy skies Wednesday night, lows down about 50. A little more rain and clouds returning for Thursday. High temperatures a little warmer, around 49.
Have something important to say? Want to help improve our world? Need to promote your business uniquely and effectively? KKNW is the answer. Our staff helps broadcasters and podcasters create professional-sounding audio. Bring your talent and let our experts help you craft a radio show or podcast that best delivers your message. Learn more at 1150kknw.com. That's 1150kknw.com. KKNW, talk variety that's live and local. The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Vasily and Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Law of Attraction, Traction, Quantum Consciousness Connection and Creation with my mom, holistic psychotherapist, Karine Beerfeld. Karine has worked in private practice for over 20 years and has witnessed miraculous recoveries treating those who've experienced trauma. Trauma stored in the body can subconsciously affect and determine our life experience. When unconscious programs and traumas are accessed and released, negative core beliefs and maladaptive behaviors can be permanently reprogrammed. Dive deeper into the Law of Attraction and go beyond whatever is blocking you from the life you want with Karine Beerfeld. The Law of Attraction, Traction starts right now.
Oh my gosh, I love that introduction. I always get like a big fat smile on my face every time I hear that, Karine. No. Karine Beerfeld, this is her show, The Law of Attraction, Traction. We are taking on healthy relationships. I'm just going to sit back here and listen.
Okay.
Oh, it's so great to have you. And boy, I'll tell you, this is really, especially the past couple of years, but even before that, this is a giant topic, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. Yes. So glad to see you. So glad to be with you today. Hi.
So let's talk about this. Yesterday was Valentine's Day.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's interesting. I got a lot of love from my birth mom. So I'm like this walking heart, really. Okay. But I have this outer shell, and so So when it comes to things like Valentine's Day, they've always been special. Mm-hmm. But if you have been in relationships, right, there aren't always such great memories of them. And so the question really is, how do we cultivate a healthy relationship? But let's start out by probably talking about what they are, because I think we recognize when they're not first. What do you think?
I think that's a great question to start with. So, yeah, so you're asking me what is a healthy relationship?
Yeah.
Right.
Healthy, solid, whatever you want to call it, whatever that language is. People react to the word healthy.
Uh-huh.
Whatever that is, you know, a relationship that gives you positive vibes, maybe not all the time, but is foundational for the two people that are in it.
Yeah. Right. And I think, isn't that what everybody is really, at the end of the day, looking for, is that we want to be around people and we want to be with people who support us, who lift us up, who are there for us when we need them, who are, you know, our cheerleaders and have our best interests at heart. I think, you know, I was just talking to a friend about this the other day about, you know, at the end of the day, when our lives are over and we look back, what is it that we're going to look back on that we have valued the most? And it's not the stuff that we've accumulated. And I don't even think it's going to be necessarily what we've accomplished in terms of career materialistically. I think it's going to be our relationships, you know, like who have we loved, who has loved us, how have we shown up for people, who's been there for us. So my perspective is, at the end of the day, that our relationships really are the most valuable thing that we have in our lives. So, yeah, I think that's a great question to get some clarity about. What does a healthy relationship look like? I mean, I think each person might have their own definition, but
yes.
You know, basic characteristics would be that, you know, that it's based in honesty and authenticity and openness and ability to be able to be vulnerable and to trust, especially if we're talking about an intimate partner, trust them with our vulnerable sides, the sides we might not show to everyone, that we can be safe, that we will be heard, that we're going to be supported no matter what.
And I want to talk to you about this, too, because, you know, whenever I've had conversations on this, or like you, whenever we've done coaching on this, if you learn a lot of things through the eyes of other people. And one of the things that I think it's really important for us to point out is that we're not talking about the relationship of perfection.
No.
Right? We're not looking at, like, the Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell version of, like, yeah. By the way, they weren't married for like a million years. So, but we're looking at
their stuff, you know.
That's what I was just going to say, right? But let's talk about how important these are, because I think one of the things you say is, at the end of the day, these relationships are so very dear and important to us.
Yeah.
You know, like I heard the intro, that was your son.
Yep.
You know, I have a best friend that I've had in my life for decades.
Yes.
At the end of the day, when we have to choose our number one thing, do we go for the new sports car or do we go for the people that are close to us?
Right. And I think, you know, when we're looking back on our lives, that's an easy answer. What really matters? It becomes much clearer, our perspective.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in terms of the perfect relationship, I don't know. Of course, there's no perfect relationship. I think the best relationships are those that are formed over time. It takes a long time of not just being able to be with each other when things are good, even when it comes to, like, your friendships or, you know, relationships with your children, but being able to navigate, and I think this makes the relationships even the strongest relationships are the ones that can navigate difficulties and challenges together and find ways to resolve conflict and learn how to communicate and to speak up and to talk about things even when it's really hard, and to, like, come from a place of really being open and honest. And, you know, I do a lot of work with couples, so a lot of times what I'm doing is helping them navigate. They don't come to me when they're in a good place. They, you know, nobody comes in to tell me how great their marriage is. You know, things are not good. And so I spend a lot of time with them helping them to understand how to communicate effectively, but also what it takes to really be able to navigate the hard times, navigate the challenges.
Boy, you just said a mouthful there, because let's talk about that. I know you work with couples, and I know that they come to you, but what do we attract in each other? See, one of the things I look back at my own life is, what had I attracted? What had I attracted that was really greatly aligned? And then what about this other thing that I attracted, this other relationship that in the end wasn't? What was I trying to fix about me?
Yes.
Isn't that the question?
An insightful question.
We can talk about that off air.
Yeah, so one of the things that I explain a lot of times when couples come in the beginning is that we're really not taught this in school. I wish it was taught, because I think it would help people so much, and we would probably have a much lower divorce rate in our country. I think we're kind of sold this idea, like a romantic idea of, you know, if you find the right person, you'll know they're the right one, because you fall in love and you have this feeling of love. And if you have that means you're meant to be together. So a lot of people go into relationships in that honeymoon stage based on that feeling. And then as the relationship plays out and they're, you know, hit with challenges that every relationship is going to face, then all of a sudden what happens is, instead of people saying, okay, what's going on? How did I end up in this relationship? How did I attract this person? What do I need to look at within myself? They say, oh, I must have married the wrong person, or I ended up in the wrong relationship. I made a bad choice. So there's the principle, which is not a real romantic principle, but it is what I have come to find is most of the time really a true principle,
mm-hmm.
is that in relationships, we do tend to attract where we have experienced our own wounds or traumas, especially in a family of origin. So we tend to attract what's familiar on an unconscious level. And the
fact
so fascinating to me about this is that the attraction will be instant. Like the principle is that a lot of times, the more similar a person is to the parent that was the more wounding parent, the stronger the attraction will be.
Yeah.
There's no way we could know that cognitively when we first meet someone. But the attraction on an unconscious level is like we're sending out these invisible signals or radio waves or whatever you want to call it, and then it can take years to play out before you actually see the patterns and how the similarities are there from our family of origin. So, for example, if somebody was raised in, like, say, a family where one of the parents had addiction issues, then it would not be uncommon for them to be attracted to or end up in a relationship with somebody who is an addict or an alcoholic.
Right.
I used to work at a battered women's shelter when I was in graduate school. And, you know, of course, over and over, we would see the women coming in who are trying to get out of these abusive relationships had grown up in families where usually it was the father who had been physically abusive to their mother. So what tends to happen, what would happen is the women would grow up and marry abusers. The little boys that grew up in situations like that would grow up to become abusers. And it's sad from one level that we do tend to unconsciously create patterns in our family of origin. But the upside to this, when you understand these principles, is that we can use our relationships then as, I think, the greatest vehicle to do our own work. And I do it all the time with couples, because when they come in, you know, if I work with somebody individually, they can kind of avoid or hide, not even that they would do it intentionally, but sometimes it's like, nope, not feeling anything. I'm not sure. I don't really even know if I have anything today. But if I have a couple sitting there and they say, man, I think I'm good. I'm not even aware of anything. All I have to do is turn to the partner and go, You know that thing that you just said? Whatever it was. And I've been like, whatever it was. And then sure enough, the spouse will be like, ah! And I just work. So I love doing couples work for that reason, because it we really, really can use our relationships as like the access point to get in touch with what we most need to heal within ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's the fascinating thing about it. But, you know, one thing you said that's extraordinary, and I don't know why more couples don't do this. I don't know why more couples don't take a proactive approach. I think perhaps because you kind of think that everything's going to be okay, that things are going to work out,
yeah,
that this has got to be the love of your life, that you fill in the blank, whatever you want. But, you know, one of the things that I know that you reference is my first introduction to Harville Hendrix,
yeah,
and Imago Therapy.
Yeah.
What year was that? I don't know, 86? Was it 86 or 87?
Yeah, getting the love you want.
Getting the love you want.
Yeah.
And getting a therapist in New Jersey that actually did that work back then. And that saved my life.
But now, you did that work. I did not know that.
It got me out of the relationship, because those of you could look it up, you know, getting the love you want.
Yeah.
Right. But the book, right, has a significant meaning, doesn't it? I mean, tell me what your thinking is about the book, because I know you're familiar with it.
Yes, I recommend it all the time to couples. It basically is a book that's kind of describing what I'm trying to put into words here, which is that, again, we will attract into our life on an unconscious level people who in some way help us recreate our patterns from our family of origin.
Yeah.
So, but again, when you understand that, then it puts you in a position to be able to do the healing work that we all need to do. A lot of people just aren't aware of it. And I think you're right when you say, I don't know why people aren't more proactive. I think we just kind of go with what's called like a default model. Like you get married, you fall in love, you have kids. And then it's like the relationship sometimes will get put to the back burner, and people then get focused on, you know, going to work, making money, paying the bills, raising the kids, and it's easy to lose sight of each other,
yeah,
making each other a priority. But when I work with couples, so one of the things that I will do is early on try to explain to them this concept, because usually they come into me and what they want in the beginning is they want me to change their partner. They both
right.
want me to change their partner's behavior. And I have to explain, like, that model doesn't work. What works is you have to do a 180. So instead of focusing on what your partner is or isn't doing that's causing you to have negative feelings, anger, resentment, sadness, hurt, whatever, it's a hard concept to grasp, hard enough to grasp cognitively, let alone start to do it, you know, on a consistent basis. But you take your attention off of what your partner is or isn't doing, and you begin to put mm-hmm. your attention on whatever feelings you're having about your partner's behavior, because that's the only place that you actually have the power. You cannot make someone else change their behavior. It's harder to grasp. I mean, it's like nobody wants to really hear that. I didn't want to hear that. It's like, no, they need to change.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, but that is really, see, that's what happens when you get a new perspective. You know, that's what happens in the work that you do with people by, you know, having folks look at the blocks that they have. Because one of the really interesting things about this is when you get that new level of awareness about yourself, and it doesn't have to be gigantic. You know, it could be something simple, like, why is it dishes in the sink puts you into a bat-you-know-what crazy rage?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But even if, like, after a million times washed it, right, you find yourself the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, and you don't. Like, that's the definition of insanity.
Yeah.
But what is it that we can do first so we can focus on clearing, or at least getting aware of what this is. You know, why is that a problem? Because when you look at something like that, you may find out that, okay, my job was to do the dishes.
Yeah.
But that was supposed to be only at dinner, not like throughout the day. That may come up like, no, it was only dinner. It wasn't like do the dishes. But if you're not aware, you can't change anything.
Right. I'm listening to you, and I'm like, do I go deep or do I? So there's two levels I could answer. I think I'm going to give you both. Okay, so top level would be the dishes in the sink are an issue. Let's just work at that level. So what I would do is, you know, help a couple communicate around that so that the person who is having the feelings about the dishes in the sink would feel heard and at least have their feelings validated. And a cognitive behavioral therapist would talk about what can you practically do so that you don't just leaving the dishes in the sink, blah, blah. But that only gets you so far. So what I like to do, because I like to go deep, right, and work that I do, is I would take that, I would focus on the person who is having the feelings, right, because that is what I will tell people from the beginning, is like whoever is having the feelings, that's the person I'm going to go to, not the person that's engaging in the behavior, the person that's having an issue with the behavior, because whoever's having the feelings, they're responsible for their feelings. And that's where you get into sort of doing like the imago work.
Yeah.
We're talking, referencing with Harville Hendricks. So what I would tend to do is to help them access earlier times in their life where they might have felt these similar feelings. Yeah. And 100% of the time, when someone's open and willing to do this kind of work, we can go back to experiences in childhood where there would be some sort of similarity to the dishes in the sink and something that happened to them as a child that would be triggering intense feelings. And usually when you are able to get to that child part, the feelings that the person is having make so much more sense. So,
What I hear you saying too is usually we scratch the surface with the kind of like foam at the top of the root beer float, like I brought up, right, about the dishes. But if you really want to get down to the ice cream and really taste what's going on, so you can enjoy, right? There you go.
And like,
go ahead.
So for example, I had one couple where the husband was more of a slob. He wasn't as clean as the wife. This drove her crazy, but to a degree where she was experiencing like rage, absolute rage around it. And so instead of spending too much time with him on how can he be a neater person, I just helped her go to what that was really about for her. And as we did the work, you know, like she was able to go back to being 12 years old and having to be the mom. I think she had like 3 or 4 siblings, and there was complete chaos in the house. And, you know, of course, if you've got a bunch of kids and she's, you know, the parents were out of whatever, they were physically absent most of the time, emotionally absent most of the time. So she was at like 12 or 13 having to kind of be the parent and navigate all this chaos within her family as the oldest. And she felt, of course, helpless and frustrated and angry. And so when you put that in perspective, so then her husband is a slob and is not taking care of the house and is recreating chaos, what happens is it brought up all of the feelings that she was still carrying from the time that she was 12 years old. But what's really cool about this kind of work is when you understand this, then all we needed to do was to allow her to have an emotional release for the 12-year-old. And a lot of what I do with clients is about, we call it reparenting the child part, like letting the child know it's okay to feel angry, it's okay to feel sad, that, you know, shouldn't have been your responsibility, and calming the child part down. And then as we do that work and the child starts to feel safe and like it's okay, the interesting thing is once you can bring healing at that level, the husband being, you know, not being super clean, didn't bring up the same level of feelings for her. She started to calm down. So that's another way to solve the problem. Instead of getting the partner to change the behavior, you deal with the feelings that are coming up, and if the behavior stops triggering you, then that solves it too. And that's the only place really that we can work, because, again, you only have the power to focus on yourself and your own healing.
Yeah. I want to make sure everybody knows, if you're just tuning in, the Law of Attraction, Traction. This is Corinne Bierfeld Show, KorenBierfeldt.com. Go to the website. You'll find out all about this. Of course, everything she's doing is there, her work, working with clients, working with the Law of Attraction. You know, Corinne, look, what you're pointing to, and one of the things we did not talk about, we should probably do a whole show on NPD, Narcissistic Personality Disorder. That is a conversation all itself. However, everything you've just said points to it. If you go up with a mom, maybe that's alcoholic and is never emotionally available, or almost schizophrenically emotionally available, the in and out, come here, go away, right? Then it's not going to be unusual to think the love of your life, who is like that, is really the love of your life. I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Attracted to someone who behaves in a similar way very wounded mother behaved, because that is what feels familiar.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, the really punchline for this for me is I thought for years I could figure this out alone. No way.
No.
We don't see ourselves, especially in relationships. And isn't that really the passion and purpose behind your work, is to really work with people to help them so that they can see themselves and create an amazing life?
Yes, it is. And I think our relationships are the most effective way to do that, because our relationships really do help us. Like, you can't hide in relationships. They bring up all of our unconscious stuff, whether we want them to or not. But that's the gift of relationships. When you see it that way, if I can get two people that both understand that principle, I get so excited, because then there's so much potential for that relationship, not to just like for them to navigate through the conflict, but for them to get to a place where they are thriving in love.
Oh, yeah.
Because then it becomes what we call a very conscious relationship. Then they're both people are approaching it from a perspective of like, if I get triggered, if you trigger me, great, because you're showing me what I need to hear within myself, you know, and vice versa. And then you start to see it not like you need to change your behavior, but I mean, when I get, I'm not always like this, but when I have a moment like this, I get really excited. I'm like, you know, like, you just triggered me. Oh, my God, this is great. Trigger me. Please, go ahead. Dib, you can trigger me, because I want to see what's next. What do I need to do? It's the next layer.
Oh, my God. And, you know, I love that we're talking about this, and I know that our time for this show is wrapping up, but there is so much more that you can talk about in the work that you do. And this is really the beginning of truly understanding how we can heal that which is inside of us.
Yeah.
Even though we may think it is somebody else that is the problem, when you see those levels of awareness from people, that has just got to make you do a happy dance.
Oh, I get so excited. Especially, it's really cool to see people do their work see the shifts that happen in the relationship.
Oh, yeah.
The work. And then what tends to happen is the more they keep focusing on their own work and their own healing, the less triggered the outside people can't trigger them then as much. I mean, you know, it's nice, because then you become more and more empowered, and you live from a place of authentic power.
Oh, my God, and isn't that the freedom? Corinne, thank you so much. Again, tell people how they can find out more about you, but also how they can work with you on this and quite the array of things you help people with.
Well,
Thank you for such a fun interview. Oh my gosh, the time just flew, as it always does with you, Dr. Pat. My office number is 440-892-0452, extension 11, and they can find information about my practice on my website, which is my name, KareenGerfeld.com.
I can't wait.
Thanks for joining the Law of Attraction Traction with host, my mom, Green Griffel. Tune in every third Tuesday of the month at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on Transformation Talk Radio and learn how you can heal from the traumas and conditions you thought were impossible. Get inspired to pursue your own healing and growth so that your light shines brighter than ever. To learn more about Kareen and her and the services she provides as holistic psychotherapist, visit her website at KareenGriffel.com.
Do you get stuck in that someday attitude, living the same day over and over again with no action? The Becoming You Show, big ideas that inspire, impact, and influence your life with Leah Rowling is for you. Tune in every Friday at 11 a.m. Central on TransformationTalkRadio.com. This show will have you feeling inspired to take action with purpose and intention. For more information and to get in touch with me, visit www.leahrowling.com.
Have you been on life's roller coaster trying to figure out what to do next? Then join Greta, me, Yvonne, and the Realm of Beings each Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Take the dust off your wings and fly to the highest heights in your thoughts and actions. Express your greatness. Be a champion for yourself, and we'll see you there on Shifting Impressions Conversations with the Realm of Beings.
Everybody, it's me, psychic medium Jamie, and me, Spirit Walker Nicole. We are so excited to introduce you to our new live call-in show called Shades of Spirit on TransformationTalkRadio.com. As we connect you with your crossover loved ones, angels, and guides, and also help you develop your own psychic and healing abilities. For more information and to book your own private experience, go to ShadesOfSpirit.com and also follow us on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome to The Pause with Ellen Wyoming Deloy. That's me. I'm your host. Life can be demanding, and most of us get caught up in the busy go, go, go. But there is great value in taking a moment to pause and reflect. Constant momentum doesn't always equate to forward momentum. And I'm here to teach you how to take a strategic pause so that your next step is purposeful and in the direction of your goals. Develop self-awareness and skills that improve your ability to walk through life with intention. This is a path toward a more balanced, fulfilling state of being. Take a beat and then take action. The Pause with Ellen Wyoming Deloy starts now.
Hi, good morning. Happy Tuesday. Happy New Year. It's my first show of 2022. And, yeah, we're getting it right. I mean, literally right now, my daughter, who just she's five today, she, as all five girls are, could not restrain herself. There's a pile of gifts sitting on the dining room table. And we timed everything just a little bit off today. It was like, oh, she got up late. Oh, I have to do the show. Oh, she's opening presents. Oh, I'm going to, and so like right before the show started, I was running out to catch at least two gifts being opened. It's okay. No one panic. My husband's out there like, it's the pandemic. Nothing is organized. It's fine. but yeah, it's been fun. And this has been a really busy time of year for me. And this is relating a little bit actually to my parent life, today's episode, or just parent life and child life in general. And so I want to just share briefly, I'm sure all of you have been just recovering from the holidays. And then early January is very busy for us in terms of continuing celebrations because both my kids are actually January. My son's birthday was 3 days ago. He's 3 years older. And so, yeah, we've just been kind of like figuring it out and then wrestling with some of those emotions that happen because they really want to have a party with their friends. And we're really figuring out how to have something maybe in February or March, just to be on the safer side. I know that the views on that really vary significantly across the country in different parts, but here it's still fairly conservative. Everyone's being really careful. And so we're still doing that and it's good. My husband also is like a medical surgical nurse at a hospital, and he's not allowed to go to work if anyone in our house gets sick, so we're just keeping it real. Anyway, so today's episode is about your inner voice. And I have been thinking about it a lot. It pops up for me from time to time. But the original way it came up for me, well, I shouldn't say original, but one of the ways that I always think about it is this quote that I saw a few years ago. I don't remember where, but I'm going to guess it was like on Instagram or something. And it said, the way that you talk to your child when they're young is the voice, their inner voice that they will hear when they are an adult. And that's always really struck me because the shaping of our inner voice, it really does get shaped by external factors. And yet there is still an inner voice within us that is just ours. And it's kind of looking for what's true for us and not, because often, you know, we walk around in the world and our inner voice is talking to us. It's kind of like, well, of course, it's just talking to us. And so that's got to be the truth. And maybe some people don't experience an inner voice in the same ways, right? It doesn't have to be an auditory voice, disembodied speaking to you, right? It can be like those gut sensations or gut feelings, right? We could kind of think of our intuition or our instincts as like facets of an inner voice. But I've always been really fascinated with it. And as a parent of young children who are getting older, right, so 5 and 8, but I have always, I've had that phrase in my mind. And it informs a lot of my parenting, probably not in the day-to-day as much as I would like when I'm tired or frustrated or like don't want the argument to happen, or, you know, just I'm like, okay, I don't have the energy to deal with this like supermom who's going to unravel it and honor every single person's feelings in the right way. Like, I'm just going to put a stop to it. So it's not perfect. And by no means am I trying to insinuate at all, if you are a parent who's listening, that like it's all on you, right? I mean, a lot of stuff is on us, but I mean, let's be real. Like, we're humans. Things are super messy. My own journey as being the daughter of my parents is its own journey, and it's been really interesting. But so what are some of the external conditions that can shape our inner voice, right? So I think a lot of it does come from early childhood, because that's where our earliest patterns are established, the way that we fit in the world. It is our anchoring for our body to be safe and secure in places. And we all have varied experiences with what that is. Some of us are incredibly fortunate, very safe, really secure, totally loved unconditionally, and have that buoyancy. And when we have that type of support in our earlier years, There can be a clarity to an inner voice there, but also I wonder if the inner voice actually has to develop against something kind of pushing up against it every now and then, so that the voice knows who it is within ourselves, for us to know who we are. So I don't think that there's any one way or perfect way to have been raised or to raise other people, but I think in an awareness and a consciousness of the development of what an inner voice could be is pretty darn important if you're responsible and tasked for helping young people grow up, regardless if you're their parent or you're a guardian or a caregiver or an adult in a child's life, right? Giving them opportunities to really be seen and heard, but then also you're going to butt heads every now and then. It's just going to happen because they're exerting a lot of will as they're kind of developing. This is making me think about how we should talk about development through the chakras at some point, but that inner voice piece is so critical. And I think the other part I wanted to mention is, if you're on the flip side and childhood is extra tough and rough, there may be a lot, and you have to, if you're growing up in a situation like that, you have to have a lot in place for your safety, security, and well-being, that you start to make these assumptions about how the world is and what is right and wrong for your safety, right? And so the way the world is when we're between, you know, birth and 7, birth and 10, and I'm not like a developmental child psychologist or anything, but this is my experience reflecting on my own life, talking with my friends about their lives, watching my own children grow. I do read some stuff because I've got kids. But that early developmental period is really where we're shaping a worldview or a lens or a perspective, right? And so that's being shaped in concert together, right? It's a dance, the body and the environment going through experiences that are shaping kind of like the rules of engagement. And the kid growing up, like a bit transient, maybe house to house, parents are working paycheck to paycheck, occasionally experiencing about homelessness, and then maybe finally finding something settled and grounded, that experience is going to be really different than the child who's born to two really wealthy parents who pay for private school, who do like all these different things. So the rules for engagement for both of those people are going to be different, even though like the neutralness of the fact that they just live on a planet called Earth is the exact same, but really different constructs around them and probably extremely different community bases that they're based within that have rules for engagement. Is one of them more right than the other? No, but have they had a significant impact in the development, of the perspective and the way that those kids are going to move through the world? Absolutely. And are they going to work for them as adults? And that's really what happens, right? If you're listening to this, you're probably not a kid. If you are a kid and you're really interested in this at 8 years old, like kudos, that's super cool. But typically it's adults who I'm talking to. And we're all kind of working to unpack the sticky mess that we've been in. And I myself am constantly like, where's the next layer of the onion that I can unpeel around myself to discover what's actually hiding underneath? And sometimes I get really tired of it and I'm like, don't pick up that rock. I don't have the energy to deal with what's under that rock right now. I'm going to go over here. I'm going to set my cup of coffee, stare out the window, and like everything's fine. And everything is fine, but I'm constantly exploring. And if you're listening, you probably are too. And so as we kind of move into what we're looking at as adults and the perspective, I'm always really interested in, Jacob is like, wait, do I want to break on the show? No, we're going to just, I'll just keep talking, Jacob, sorry. but what does it look like as an adult when we're trying to discover if we're having our truth within our inner voice, right? So the inner voice development is the perspectives that we have about how the world is, what we're allowed to do, what we give ourselves permission to do, even if we don't know that we actually have the power of deciding if we have permission. Sometimes this is a theme that pops up quite a bit when I'm doing readings for folks, like when I'm looking at a picture for them about what's your truth in this situation. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, you are moving into a growth period around having permission to do the thing that you want to do for yourself, right? So kind of clearing through the energy of limitation. And so it's like how to explain nonlinear concepts through speech is like always really interesting for me. And let's see here. Sorry. So how do you know if it's your truth for your inner voice? Is kind of where I'm going with this. So as we get to be adults, we've got the perspective. It's shaped us. We got two people, three people, 7 billion people with really different experiences. Some of them, thankfully, are in common enough, right? Like, we all shouldn't be murderous, crazy people. And I think 99% of us on the planet, probably even more than that, 99.9, because there's a lot of us, we all want good. We don't want to be harmed. We don't want to harm others. And there are some damaged and wounded people out there who do it anyway. But most, for the most part, I like know this looking around in my community, like most of us are just wanting to be good people. We want to be seen. We want to be heard. We want to be valued. Because there's some like common human condition things, right? And we want to know and experience love if we get right down to it. And then on the other side of that, we want to experience love, but we also want to experience healing and forgiveness. Because like, gosh, we get born, we're born kind of perfect, and then we get shaped with whatever the conditions are, and then we have those conditions kind of ensconced around us as adults. And there's usually a point, if you're really interested in this kind of stuff, you're kind of like, this isn't working for me. This isn't right. And what is it that hits you where it's not working quite right anymore? And what is it about your inner voice that helps you to know that? And so let's talk about our inner voices, right, and kind of extrapolate that to, like, how we know where we want to move forward. I recently watched this movie. It's called Violet. It came out last year. It stars Olivia Munn, and I thought it was such a great example of, like, the inner voice concept. It's an independent film. It's very conceptual. It's about experience, and Olivia Munn or that character, she's playing the character Violet, she realizes that because she calls it the committee in her head, and it's actually a voiceover with the actor Justin Theroux, very deep voice, ominous tones, and he's punishing. He's a punishing inner voice. So she'll be, and she's like a super successful television producer, executive kind of person in Los Angeles in the movie. And she'll be like working on deals or talking to people, and the voice in her head starts to like talk over because she's doing something out of her truth, and the voice development, the development of this voice is also out of the truth. It's the voice that got shaped through her childhood. And we get a flashback of like a punitive, kind of shaming, punishing family framework that intuits, right? But this was the development of her inner voice. And so she's sitting like at dinner in a scene with a friend of hers, and she's going, the committee in my head, you know, it's like they're always telling me to do this, but it feels really bad every time I do that, even though that's what keeps me safe. And it's cool because in these moments where she's like tolerating her jerk boss, shaming her in front of a group of people because he is taking a power trip because she actually just did something really great and he's jealous of her success, the boss like starts to really in public like start to shame her in a way that everyone's really uncomfortable with, but no one is courageous enough to stop him. And so she sits there and she's just smiling and she's just going, yep, I deserve this. Don't snap. Don't do anything wrong. Make it smooth. And it's that ominous voice that's saying it. And all of a sudden the screen is like fading to red and you can just see her like collapsing in herself. And I was like, okay, well, that's a great example of an inner voice that's been developed to keep you safe, possibly in childhood, so you wouldn't get slapped or punished, right? Physically harmed, perhaps, so you can get through the day-to-day in your home life. But as an adult, is that working for Violet / Olivia Munn? Not so much. And so her thing in the movie is to just stop listening to the voice because she's at a point where she's like, it doesn't feel good. It makes me feel terrible. And it's this really sweet movie. And every time she takes a step in the direction of like, there's this sense of golden light that kind of shows up through the film for when it actually matches her, but she's never been allowed to have it. When she like very scarily, she's so scared to do it. But when she starts to make the choices to go in that direction, you just see the voice lose power. And it's like really cool. And so that's the thing that like I've been thinking about the past couple of weeks, because I was like, that is really important because we can start to reshift and change as adults our inner voices. But it can be very, very scary. And I think that's what the film really helped illuminate the most, is that the conscious decision to change the soundtrack that's been going on for such a long time in our heart or in our stomach or in our mind is scary, because we weren't able to do it when we were really young, or we weren't able to practice it in confidence, right? And so it's kind of like, if you go to the psychological perspective, right, the ego is constantly protecting us, right? And it's why we end up snapping or having these weird conversations or arguments or like ego battles that people have, because they can't be wrong, because if they're wrong, they're going to be punished or something like that, right? Even though the thing about it is not even really real or consequential, everyone's ego could step aside, we'd have a lot more productive conversations around the planet, wouldn't we? So how do you start to step into the bravery of doing the opposite thing when you know, and you don't even know what the opposite thing is sometimes? How do you just know not to listen to the voice when the voice feels like it's had such control? And so that film actually made me think about a way that I had been using my voice in a way. And I decided to do an experiment. I didn't just decide it analytically. I kind of emotionally decided it because parts of that film really resonated with me. And I think if anyone watches it, it might have highlights for you. I think particularly if you had a bit of a more emotionally tumultuous childhood. Mine wasn't like what Violet was, with a really abusive and punishing mother figure. Like, I didn't have that. But there was a lot of, like, emotion. I would call it emotional chaos in my house growing up. And parts of it, like, shaped a lot of who I am. And I realized that what I have been doing is I've been hiding a lot of grief around some things over the past 10 years. And I have this voice that definitely comes up, and it hit me over the holidays. I was like, and after I watched the movie, I was like, that's what that is. Because I still, I will, like, punish myself in my mind for not doing certain things with my parents in ways that, like, I wish I could be doing them. And I will start to sort of spin out and think about, well, this is why I can't do it. And I'll try to start to explain my behavior, or I'll try to really analyze and understand their behavior, even though I have no deep insight into, like, the workings of what they're doing. I can see what they're doing on the surface, and I understand that there's a lot of operating out of wounds. But am I better than them, right? So I'm, like, start, like, trying to question myself. Like, is that very, like, are you being a good daughter? There's all these constructs, right, that I have. And I just never talk about it. I never talk about it super in depth, about the grief that I've experienced and not having what I thought I would have in, like, adult parent-child relationship with my parents, who are both still with us and alive. And I don't talk about it. My husband gets to hear about it a lot, or he gets to hear me cry about things a lot. And a couple of my close friends, like, know what's been going on, but I've never talked about it. And the inner voice that I had was shielding me through pride, blame, shame, projecting, like, all these other behaviors, to just kind of keep me safe from acknowledging some of the profound grief that I have. And I didn't know how to let the grief out or access it. I'm not super skilled in, like, grief. It's just because I'm kind of like, I realized I had this hard line. I'm like, well, if nobody died, everything's fine. And that's not true. It's not always fine, as we know. And I know that for other people, but I didn't know how to have that for myself. My voice doesn't allow that for me, right? And I can think about where that came from, right? Like, my mom isn't allowed to have grief. Nope, not really. My dad isn't allowed to have grief. Mm-mm, not really. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, we're not sad. Everything is okay, right? And it's not okay. I'm very sad. And I'm laughing and smiling right now because it's like, I'm past where I was even 3 weeks ago on this. But it was really interesting. And for me, the doing the opposite of the voice, which is what Violet was doing in the movie, she was like, I'm just not going to do that thing that the voice is telling me to do. I'm just not going to do it. And she would make a really distinct personal choice that was actually her true inner voice, standing up for herself. And for me, it was like, I have to talk about this. And so I started to talk about it. And I actually talked about it once. I wrote a very long blog post that was separate from what I usually write about or what I talk about. It was much more personal. And I sat there and I clicked send, and I even wrote in there, like, I'm going to go back and edit this 8 million times and or completely take it down, I'm pretty sure. And I haven't taken it down, but I have gone back and edited it, because simply putting it out into the world and having some people write back to me about what it meant to read something like that for them pushed me into deeper understanding of what I was doing and how my voice, the one that was really afraid of experiencing grief and also afraid of just doing things wrong and dishonoring my parents, was actually the thing keeping me from being able to transmute, like, a lot of the pain of what is from happening. And, like, stuff has definitely shifted over the past, I guess it's been about 3 weeks since I originally wrote that, because I ignored the voice that said, don't talk about this. Don't tell people about your family stuff. Don't hide. Like, just don't, you know, like, keep holding on to the guilt for being a bad daughter. Like, all those things. And it's totally shifted. And I'm like, I did the opposite. I talked about it. I wrote about it. And I wrote about it in a way, finally, because there's been, like, other work that's had to happen, where I'm not upset at my parents. I'm actually able to see them for where they're at. And when I interact with some of their behaviors, do I enjoy it? Not always. Absolutely not. I'm sure they don't enjoy me all the time. Absolutely not. But it's the permission to be messier, and I think that's, okay, it's kind of like what it was, right? The permission to be messier and not perfect within a family construct, which is totally a picture my mom had, right, that I didn't realize I adopted so much as my own, to have, like, really good like, it looks good on paper kind of stuff. And it's like, no, the paper was like a scratch ink drawing over a mess pile, right? Like, no one dealt with so many important things. And no one was abused or really hurt or anything, but, like, there was a lot of emotional damage that, like, took place because of hiding and not addressing stuff. And so I was like, wow, that's really powerful. And I could take my voice and say, I'm not going to listen to the you that says protect all this and hide it. I'm going to do the opposite. And it made movement happen. So for you, you may not have that exact situation. I mean, how could you? But what are you going to do if you want to be uncovering your inner voice? And so here's a hint. And it's really tricky because it's about nuance and discernment for what you're feeling inside of your body. But I've got a couple rules of thumb for getting into your body to kind of figure out what your inner voice really is. And the first thing I'll say is that it's hard to know if you're trying to escape your body all the time, but I think you might get what I mean by that. Like, if people aren't present, they're not in their body. They're in their phone. They're in their computer. They're in their whatever that they're watching on TV. Or sometimes it's even like they're in a book, and the book is an escapist kind of thing as opposed to something that they're reading for actual real pleasure and enjoyment. There's a line when it happens because we can't be in ourselves because it's too messy. And that's the sense of being out of your body. So before you try to go and go figure out the true nature of your inner voice, check in if you're getting into your body, because this could be a longer process. And I don't mean that to discourage you. I mean that to set up the expectation that it's important to be in our bodies. And that's, honestly, for me, I have found that through movement. I have found that through mindfulness and meditation. And I have found that through supports that I get through acupuncture, Chinese medicine, and yoga practice, honestly. And you can decide what works for you. That's the thing. There's not any perfect, tried and true method. Everyone will try to sell you the thing that's like, this is the way to get in for inner peace. And it's like, you got to figure out what works for you. We're all like uniquely a little bit different. But get into the body, find a method to start practicing that brings you in, even for 5 minutes a day, that gets you separate from thinking about what people are saying or getting distracted. If you're getting, like, I had a very distracted day yesterday where I couldn't focus on one thought, like, all the way through to the finish line, and I had to, like, stop and think, what was I doing 5 seconds ago that made me think of this? And I was like, oh, I'm just chasing things outside of my body. It's weird, and I had to go meditate for half an hour to come back in. But it's getting into the body so you can start to feel and experience what sensations are, and that practice will start to help you discern thoughts that are going through the mind, right? Thoughts that are going through the mind and starting to notice that they are thoughts, like I have this episode, first episode of my podcast, Inner Light with Ellen, with Dr. Tia Ho, and we're talking about how we're always the blue sky and our thoughts, feelings, and emotions are clouds going across the blue sky. And I think it's lovely to think about getting back to being only blue sky in nature, but we're always going to have clouds going through, and it's knowing enough to get observational with it that our thoughts are not us is like the next step there. Our thoughts are not us. They're the thoughts, feelings, and beliefs that we're habituated to going through our minds, activating experiences we had that help reinforce the perspective that it is us, but it's actually not us. And we can start to get some space from it. And we can get some space from our thoughts, feelings, and emotions. I don't mean disassociate from them. I mean actually be so present that we can see that they are not exactly us, even though they are a part of our experience. You will start to discern the findings within that of your inner voice, because I'll give you a hint, your inner voice feels good to you. Your inner voice supports you and loves you and allows you to feel wholeness despite conditions around you, if there may be unwholeness, right? All right, that's time for me today. And I would love, if you have questions, feel free to contact me. You can find me on my website, ellenwyomingdeloy.com. I do coaching. I've got new coaching packages for 2022 lined up, two different life coaching packages, and work for emerging entrepreneurs as well as folks who are in an executive space in their work. You can check them out. I also do intuitive readings. You can book those as well. So just go to my website and you'll see everything that's there to tinker around with. And I really look forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you for being here. Thanks for being here on The Pause.
Whenever you are listening and wherever you're listening from, we hope this time gives you some space from your day to reflect and gain some insight into where you're going and how you can make your next steps count. If you're really looking to jump into your personal growth journey, schedule a free consultation with me and learn how my coaching can help you to start taking meaningful action in your life today. Visit my site, ellenwyomingdeloy.com. See you next time.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
And good Tuesday to you. Benny Mathers here for a look at your Alternative Talk AM 1150 traffic update for around this hour. We have a collision on State Route 507 southbound at milepost 40 at the Eastgate Road area not too long ago. It's actually blocking the roadway in both directions, so look out for a detour in that area and slowing. That's State Route 507 around milepost 40 at Eastgate Road. Stay tuned for Coffee with the Universe and Laura Goldstein coming up next on the Transformation Talk Radio Network.
NBC News Radio, I'm Lisa Taylor. President Biden will update the nation on the Russia-Ukraine crisis this afternoon. He's scheduled to speak from the White House at 3:30 Eastern Time. His speech follows Russia's claim that it's withdrawing some troops from the border with Ukraine, but Ukrainian officials have expressed deep skepticism. A settlement's being reached between gun manufacturer Remington and families of Sandy Hook shooting victims. Dina Kodiak has more.
The family's lawyer said the AR-15 is a military weapon, and he made calls for the weapon to be banned from the everyday public. He said the case has a lot to do with greed from the gun companies and added Remington used to be a responsible company until they were sold to a private firm.
Researchers at the University of Utah are making a key discovery about how COVID-19 can spread from person to person. A newly published study shows mucus prevents any coronavirus from spreading on surfaces. Researchers say mucus and saliva contain proteins that inhibit virus infection. The study shows direct transmission is more likely to come through breathing in respiratory droplets from an infected person or through direct contact. An NYPD officer is being promoted after taking down the gunman who killed two other officers earlier this year. The police commissioner promoted Sumit Sulan to detective today. Salon directed family members to safety during a shootout between other officers and a gunman following a domestic violence call in Harlem back in January. Salon shot and killed the suspect, LaShawn McNeil, after McNeil shot and killed officers Jason Rivera and Wilbert Mora. The police commissioner says Salon's actions likely saved more lives. Cities across Florida stand to take on an economic hit as the start of Major League Baseball spring training is on hold. Rick Herschel has details.
Pitchers and catchers were scheduled to start reporting to camp to begin gearing up for the 2022 MLB season. However, uncertainty continues to hang over both the spring training and regular season schedules as the league remains in a lockout. The Sunshine State is home to 15 MLB teams that play games during the Florida Grapefruit League season.
You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
Here are the major rules for all KKNW Call to Win contests. After our contest on-air cue to call, the first completed call received at 888-298-KKNW or number given at time of contest will be selected and verified as the winner. You can win a prize valued up to $100. To be eligible, you must be at least 18 years old, have not won in the last 30 days, and reside within the KKNW listening area. Complete contest rules are available at 1150kknw.com.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Vasili and Transformation Talk Radio.
How do you start your day? Are you focused, energized, and tuned in to your higher self? Or do you wake up anxious, unmotivated, and already overwhelmed by your giant to-do list? Welcome to Coffee with the Universe with Laura Goldstein, where we'll have inspiring and practical conversations around how to reverse daily struggle and show up calm, collected, and confident instead. As a psychotherapist, spiritual advisor, yoga teacher, and influential speaker, Laura will discuss all things morning routine for increased productivity, mental clarity, greater connection with self, and better decision-making. So grab your favorite cup of joe and come sit down with Laura. Coffee with the Universe starts now.
Hello and welcome, everyone, to this episode of Coffee with the Universe. And I'm going to be talking about Kundalini yoga. So this episode is for all the yogis and yoginis out there, whether you're a beginner, whether you are more advanced, or whether you are just interested in participating, trying, experimenting with some form of yoga. It's no secret that the benefits of yoga are many, but I wanted to dive in today to the Kundalini style. So just like we have many different flavors of ice cream, we also have many different flavors of yoga. You have your vinyasa, you have Iyengar, Ashtanga, Hatha, your Bikram hot yoga, Kundalini. So this isn't a debate about like which is the best form of yoga. They're all different, just like there is no such thing as best ice cream flavors. I mean, that's very subjective. And the yoga that you practice is going to be very specific to you and what works for you. Now, for me, my background is in Iyengar, which is a Hatha form of yoga, and it's very much in like to alignment and how to get in proper position. And I'll be honest, I was doing like vinyasa flow classes before I found my Iyengar school, and I have to say, I wasn't really doing yoga properly, so I attribute my level of skill and my ability to go through yoga teacher training in the Kundalini form on my Iyengar Hatha yoga background experience. But as someone who has a very busy mind, some of you out there can relate, where we're like very high in vata air energy and our mind is always going a mile a minute and it doesn't shut up. And, you know, we're looking for something to just like quiet the mind to get it to stop. I found that Kundalini actually helped me a lot more than some of these other forms. And I'll be honest, if you know yoga and you've heard of Kundalini, a lot of people are like, well, that's the weird kind of yoga. And I admit, I thought that at first. You know, a lot of people, like, they're dressed in all white. Sometimes they're chanting. And, you know, as someone who was just used to kind of vinyasa flow classes that I could get at the gym, I'm like, this is really weird stuff. It just doesn't jive. And I did a couple Kundalini classes way back when, and we were doing like these strange repetitive movements, and I was like holding my arms up in the air, and I'm like, why am I even doing this? It was really confusing and really strange. And I happened to show up to a class, you know, I'm dressed in like regular yoga gear, but this is a very classical Kundalini studio. So like almost everybody was dressed in white. I felt like completely out of place. I had no idea why everybody was dressed in white. Why does the teacher cover their head? You know, this is like so bizarre. So I wrote it off for such a long time, just saying, you know, this is like weird cult crazy crap. This isn't yoga. But as I became more experienced and started to dabble more on my own, I realized that one instance of my experience is not all instances. It's like going to one yoga class and not really liking it and saying, oh, I don't like any form of yoga. Like I went to that Kundalini class and I was like, oh, I don't like any Kundalini. I just, it was from a place of ignorance and I wasn't ready for it at the time. But I just want to dive into why I have found this school of yoga to really help me work through my mind chatter and a lot of the subconscious junk that we have lurking underneath than other forms of yoga. I actually found someone who was doing Kundalini online that looked like a normal person to me. So I started following it and started doing it at home. And the amount of stillness that I found was just astronomical. I don't even know how to explain it. And I realized that the way Kundalini works is it's a little bit more holistic in the elements that are included. And I'll go over that in a little bit. But I think it's this more holistic approach to the yoga practice that really made the difference to me. And a lot of forms of yoga, most forms we think of just like asana practice, like I'm going to do a power flow and it's going to make my butt and my abs look good. I'm going to be all nice and toned. And especially here in the West, we see it as a form of exercise, you know, cardio, heart rate is up. But, you know, yoga, if you're advanced, you know this, yoga is much deeper than that. There's a whole philosophy behind it. It's not just about asana and movement. We have pranayama, which is the breath work. We have mantra, which is sound and vibration. And I went to this, so this is funny. Before I got into Kundalini, before I even did teacher training, I was still like a beginner yoga. I went to an ashram weekend retreat with a girlfriend when I was still living in Florida. We're like, oh, this will be fun. We had an ashram there. Let's go to a yoga retreat for the weekend. So we went, and it was quite interesting because first off, I am insulin resistant. So I'm like a paleo keto girl. I need my meat. So we were going for the weekend to an ashram where everybody's a vegetarian and feeding me all kinds of grains and vegan food, which is often very high in carbohydrates. So I actually stored a bunch of like beef jerky and sardines in my car. So I was like this little, you know, I felt like this little ashram derelict where like meal time, I would like run to my car and eat my protein and then come back to the community kitchen and dining area and like have a salad and some vegetables to go with it. So I did feel like a little bit of a derelict, like sneaking away. I'm eating meat in my car secretly. So it was really funny that way, but we did a lot of chanting and mantra. And I remember thinking, I guess I expected, you know, a yoga retreat. This was my beginner yoga mind. I'm going to go and we're just going to have all different kinds of yoga classes and maybe like a meditation. But at the ashram, they did a much more holistic style, like what I found with Kundalini. So, yeah, we did some asana. We did some meditation. But there was a lot of presentations about, like, yoga philosophy and the eight limbs of yoga. And they did a lot of mantra and chanting. And I'm sitting, like, in Sanskrit or Gurmukhi. And I'm like, what are they even saying? I don't get this. This is so weird. And so myself and my girlfriend, we found ourselves kind of like sneaking away from some of the sessions because we just thought it was weird. Again, we were beginners and nobody really prepped us or educated us as to what was going on. And so we were a little uncomfortable. It was out of our element. I can look back on that and laugh, especially like running out to my car to eat sardines. You know, there's a sight for you. But it was a good experience, and it exposed me to the different styles of yoga and, you know, even the difference between a more Buddhist-based philosophy school and more like Hindu-based philosophy school. There's a difference, you know, in Buddhism, it's more like Zen, quieting the mind. There isn't much, like there's no deity discussion, whereas in the Hindu religion, yes, they talk about deities and use stories around the different gods and goddesses to prove a particular point. So even something like that in the ashram that I went to had all these different, it was very Hindu-based, had all these different deities, and, you know, you have the one with, like, many different arms, and you've got, the elephant, like, part human, part elephant. So, again, for someone who is born and raised, like, on Catholicism, like, that was just strange. You know, they have all of these different gods and goddesses, and I don't know what they mean. And even though now I consider myself a pretty intermediate yogini, the Hindu side of it doesn't resonate as much to me. But that is an option, and other people do find enjoyment in the stories and the history behind that. But just, you know, so you understand, it's okay if we want to experiment with different forms of yoga. It's okay if we find something that is a little uncomfortable to us, because it's just allowing us to step outside our comfort zone. And sometimes we need that in order to find a style that really works for us. And when I tell people now that I teach the Kundalini style, those that know me, that know how I would like laugh at, you know, Kundalini, and I'm not getting up at 4 a.m., which I still don't, by the way, to, you know, do morning practice, they kind of chuckle, because it is ironic that something that I toted as weird and strange and the chanting and, oh my gosh, I don't understand that, I now decided that that's what I decided to get my teacher training in, and that's what I teach now. Now, granted, I do teach more of a modern Kundalini. I am not of the Sikh religion or tradition, so I don't wear all white. And I think the thing that makes the difference when experimenting or exploring a Kundalini class, it's having a teacher that tells you why you're doing what you're doing. You know, for those that teach, I guess, you know, if they have a following, they assume everybody already knows. I don't really know. It's very confusing to new people who are coming in and doing things that seem really strange, and you don't get it. And when we don't, when we can't intellectualize something, it's harder to adjust and be accepting of it. It's like the ego needs to understand something before it can allow for us to be in the experience. Now, as a spiritual being, quote, should it be that way? No, because if we were actually all in our divinity, we would be open to any experience and we wouldn't be judging it. However, for most of us, we still struggle with that ego part, with that mind, that self-identification. And when we go to try something new, if we can have an understanding of what's going on, our mind will allow us to experience it in a different way than if we have no clue and we can't make sense out of what it is that we're doing. So I do think it's important to understand a little bit about Kundalini, and that's what I aim to do in today's show. Something else I want to kind of talk about, you know, the elephant in the room is scandal. So the person that brought Kundalini style to the United States and Canada was Yogi Bhajan, and there's a huge scandal around that. You know, him and his ashram, and, you know, being very inappropriate with women, and he was accused of, you know, sexual misconduct. So a lot of people have discounted Kundalini because of that. However, just like in any organization, you do find scandal, you do find inappropriate behavior, people who abuse their authority. So this isn't anything new. So I do want to address that a little bit, because I've seen some people call Yogi Bhajan the father of Kundalini, and that makes me cringe, because Kundalini yoga, like all forms of yoga, have been here for thousands of years, way before this one guy was even born. So to say, you know, to put somebody on a pedestal and say, oh, this is the father of Kundalini, I find it extremely inappropriate and not actual. Now, did he bring the style to the West? Absolutely. So, you know, there is credit there. But that doesn't make somebody the founder of or the father of. Yoga doesn't belong to any one person. It's not taught by any one guru. So to view it in that way, I just think really taints it. And then, you know, it sets people up for huge disappointment. And then, like, giving up something that they love, whether it's a yoga practice, whether it's a particular religious institution. I mean, you find the same thing with, you know, the priests. You find it anywhere in politics and, you know, any businesses, there's going to be corrupt, abusive people. So I do want to go into that a little bit too and talk about what that looked like. Because if you know Kundalini, you know what I'm talking about probably, but if you don't, you're going to hear it. So I want you to at least have the background information. Okay, so when we come back, I'm going to address the weirdness, like the Sikh part of Kundalini. And I want to talk about this scandal a little bit more just so you have a fundamental understanding, and then dive into why Kundalini is the yoga of awareness and how it can really help you with the chatter of the mind and these subconscious blocks that often prevent us from, you know, finding that level of peace and joy that we really want. So I will see you after the break.
Imagine what it would be like to turn your pain into purpose. Tune in to Transformation with Martinet every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Martinet and her guests are here shining their lights today through empowering stories of hardship and transformation. Begin to see your life in a new light. Visit MartinetEmmons.com and tune in every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific to Transformation with Martinet. You're driven, and it totally shows. Your career is taking off. You're killing it in the mom game. But did your health needs make it on the plate this week? Tune in to the Boss Up Babe radio show, where Carissa Adkins helps babes show up, boss up, and thrive. Every second and fourth Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Become the boss babe you were meant to be. To sign up for one of Carissa's group coaching programs, visit 365DailyHustle.com.
Tired of not losing the weight? You need a healthy solution for weight loss that protects your muscle mass as the fat burns away naturally. Holistic Medical Center has the healthy option for your weight loss concerns. Lose 1 to 3 pounds per day in 21 days, naturally, under our physician supervision. Call Holistic Medical Center, 425-451-0404. Or on the web, drdarvish.com, drdarvish.com.
We figured by the time we turned 50, we kind of had life figured out, but we were not prepared for the realities of midlife. Tune into And That's When I Realized, the truth and comedy of midlife, with me, Susan Dolce,
and me, Leon Dyer, every second and fourth Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. You're not alone in these challenges, and sometimes you just gotta laugh.
Find us at SusanDolce.com
and LeonDyer.com.
Tune in to the Sacred Attunement Show with Asher Countryman, unlocking the power of mind, body, soul abundance. Tune in every first and third Friday at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join Asher as she guides you to sacred attunement. Align your mindset and your actions to master your life's purpose. Discover more at sacredattunement.com.
When trauma is stored in the body, it can subconsciously affect and determine our life experience.
Learn how the mind connects with the body and how you can pursue your own healing and growth so that your light shines brighter than ever. On the Law of Attraction Traction with host, my mom, Green Beerfield. Every third Tuesday of the month at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To learn more about Kareen and her services as a holistic heart-centered counselor, visit KareenBeerfield.com. Coffee with the Universe. Today we're talking about the Kundalini style of yoga and my experience with it, as well as why I found it to really help those of us that have an incredibly busy, overactive, self-critical mind, as well as, you know, just like some subconscious stuff that's lingering there, whether it's like past discomfort, resentments, even some trauma, why I found this form of yoga to be most effective. So in before the break, we talked a little bit about like the weirdness behind it, wearing all white, you know, the Sikh religion, and then, you know, the scandal around Yogi Bhajan, who brought Kundalini to the West. So I just want to briefly kind of go into that. So you do see, like, if you Google Kundalini yoga and you watch YouTube videos, most of them you will see wearing like all white, their heads are covered, men usually have turbans on. And this is because in India, a huge population that practiced Kundalini were those of the Sikh faith. And yeah, Sikhism is in essence a religion, and so there is some of that incorporated into Kundalini, but Kundalini is not religious in itself. Like, it's not teaching a particular deity. It's very neutral in talking about, you know, like, you can use the word God if you want in some of the mantras and meditations, but you can also use spirit, universe, whatever works for you. So while, you know, when a particular religion practices one form of yoga, you can't help but get a little bit of that in there. Just like, you know, with Hinduism, you get a little bit of that in any kind of style yoga that you practice, and you can kind of take it with a grain of salt. If it resonates, great. If not, that's okay too. So just because Kundalini is very popular amongst the Sikh religion, it doesn't mean that Kundalini is religious and that you have to be Sikh and wear all white and wear the turbans in order to practice or teach it. My class is not like that at all. As a matter of fact, I was just telling my producer here that I had a new woman come to one of my classes, and she was wearing all white, and she saw that I wasn't, and she was like, oh my gosh, she said, I'm so glad, you know, I had to go to the store and get this top because I didn't have any, and, you know, I was afraid that I would show up and I wouldn't be in all white and it would be weird. So not all people who practice Kundalini are going to be dressed in all white, and many of them do not have any experience or immersion into the Sikh faith. Okay, so it'd be kind of like saying, well, we had a study and we noticed that most people who practice vinyasa were, you know, of the Jewish faith. Therefore, you know, vinyasa is for Jewish people only. I mean, that's not how it works. It's just something that stands out because if you are of a different religion, like Jewish faith or of Christian orientation, you don't always know this based on how people look, but with like the Sikh faith, it is quite obvious by the way that they're dressed. And same with, you know, people who are of Muslim faith, they have, you know, the head covers as well as the women do. So it's a little bit more obvious than some of the other religions, but, you know, the weirdness because of the white
It's not a mandatory part of Kundalini. So don't let that deter you from trying it if that was a hang up for you. Now, in terms of the scandal Yogi Bhajan, you know, he had kind of like an ashram, and is it a cult? I believe it kind of was. I think that any gathering where people are following one guru and they take that person's word for it, like a be-all, end-all, that is kind of the definition of a cult. So was he running a cult? Yeah, I guess you could say that. However, you have to remember this is also the late 60s and into the 70s, and you had a lot, the hippie movement and this idea of, you know, we live on a commune and a sense of community. So the time, too, also promoted this kind of hippie, communal, cult-like living. And again, you know, he was accused by being of being sexually inappropriate. But you can really find that in any industry. I mean, even within yoga, I mean, Iyengar was accused of being, you know, verbally abusive to the students. So it's infused in anything. And my message is don't let, like, one person deter you from experiencing something that is not of that person. Yogi Bhajan did not invent Kundalini, you know, so, and, you know, to be honest, there were a couple Kundalini teachers at the studio that I teach at right now. I'm the only one that teaches Kundalini there, but there were a couple Kundalini instructors before me that would wear all white that I guess, you know, believed more in the Sikh religion and the principles there. But one of the ladies, when this scandal hit, she renounced Kundalini and, like, swore she would never do it again. She held this person in such esteem that when he was accused of these horrendous things, and, I mean, he's passed. He's already deceased. So we don't really know. Like, he couldn't answer for his accusations or his accused crimes because he had already died. But this person, like, held him in such esteem that, like, her whole world was shattered. And I think that's the danger of taking any kind of yoga guru and putting him on this pedestal and almost, like, worshiping them because they are human beings and they are fallible. And it is possible that they will mess up, some in more serious ways than others. But that doesn't mean that the form of yoga, that Kundalini itself or all yoga itself is bad. You know, yoga's been around for a lot longer and it has so many benefits. So we don't want to attach it to any one person or thing. So try not to let scandals get in the way of you trying different things, especially when it comes to yoga and practices in the health and wellness field. All right, so Kundalini is the yoga of awareness. And the reason why it's called this is because it actually focuses more on the subtle energetic body and what you are noticing about your body and your mind as you go through the practices than on the asana, the forms itself. So what do I mean by that? All right, if you go to a yoga flow class in a gym or like a power flow in a studio, you are basically moving through one pose to another pose to another pose. It's a flow. Sun salutations, you know, downward dog, into plank, into different positions. A lot of yoga is focused on posture. And that's not bad because asana practice was actually created not for physical exercise to make your abs and butt look good. It was actually to prepare people for meditation because when we move our body and when we breathe in a sequenced way, it actually does quiet our mind. It helps to decompress our nervous system and it sets us up to be more meditative. So asana is very important. However, in the Kundalini school of yoga, movement is only a third or a fourth of the actual class. And a lot of the Kundalini movements are different than traditional downward dog, lunge poses, camel pose. There is some hatha infused in Kundalini, but a lot of the motions are different. You don't find that in a traditional vinyasa flow class. And that is because Kundalini is more about moving the energy up from the base of our spine, our root chakra, pushing that energy up to our crown chakra, seventh chakra. It is more focused on moving the energy in the body through repetitive movements versus just going through a set sequence of postures, right? So the movement is different. And then also in Kundalini, it's a nice infusion of that movement with pranayama, which is that breath work, with mantra, and with meditation. So this is why I say it's almost like a holistic yoga practice, because it's incorporating all of those limbs of yoga. It's incorporating all of the elements of yoga into one practice. And when we pair movement with breath work, with mantra, which is sound vibration, with meditation, and we take time to notice the impact that it's having on the body, start to pay attention to what this yoga experience is actually bringing to the table. When I first started doing yoga, I was going to the gym. I wasn't going to a regular studio. I was going to the flow class, and I thought that the ending part, the shavasana, where you lie on your back and just kind of go within, I thought it was like the biggest epic waste of time. I would lie there and be like, oh gosh, what am I going to do next? And don't forget to get this and that at the store. Because I did not understand that to make a connection as to the impact yoga is having, it's not about how you feel doing the postures. It's about how do you feel after? What do you notice? And Kundalini forces you to pay attention to that and really be aware, like what comes up for you. So for example, after we do a series of movements, I will tell my students to just notice. I take time in between every sequence that we do to say, focus on what's going on in your body. Where do you feel it? Where do you feel this energy moving? Do you feel tingling in your shoulders? Do you feel clarity in your head? Where is this impacting you and what is it doing? Because if we can make the connection between what we've just done and where we're feeling it in the body and what it's doing, then when we need to have that same sense, like, you know what, I'm having a really bad anxiety day and I need to calm my mind, you know what? Kundalini taught me that when I do these sequences and I pair it with this breath work, that it gives me relief. But if we don't take the time to understand that about our yoga practice, then we don't make the connection. And then when we are having those overly anxious days, we don't like have any tools to help us because we're not connecting the dots. So we want this awareness in the practice to be able to repeat and to use when we need to. Another part of the awareness is it teaches us about our resistance and where the ego comes into play. With Kundalini, the idea is that we hold positions, like we will hold our arms up 45 degrees, 90, 60 degrees, 90 degrees, and we'll hold them there for 3 minutes to 11 minutes. In hardcore advanced classes, you might be there for a half hour. So when you are doing this and your arms are burning like a mofo, your ego is like, this is so stupid. Why are you doing this? And the resistance starts kicking in. And you learn how you cope with difficult situations real quick. Do you give up? Do you press on? Do you get really angry? It teaches you a lot about how you cope with discomfort. And it's very insightful because I learned that I will give up. Like if I have to fight too hard, I'm just going to put my arms down and not do it and just kind of be passive aggressive. And Kundalini taught me that this is how I approach almost everything in my life that is difficult. It's very eye-opening. Again, that Kundalini of awareness. And so when we can understand how we cope, when we're doing breath work and, you know, we're doing a particular form and it's bringing up like some of these things that were from our past that we didn't think were connected, we're now becoming aware. Right? So this is why I found that the Kundalini style really helps you understand who you are, but also clear out some of those patterns, because unless we're aware, we can't do anything about it. All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to dive more into the movements like pranayama, what that looks like, mantra, chanting, and yes, it may seem weird and might be uncomfortable, but I want to talk about why this works and works really well, and then the meditation feature. So I will see you in a few.
Courageously Expanding Love on my new show, The Elizabeth Cunningham Show, every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join me and my guests where we talk about relationships, sex, love, and the ways we wish we could be but never thought were possible. Visit ElizabethAnnCunningham.com and subscribe.
Are you feeling lost in this journey we call life? When you awaken the truth of your patterns, limitations, and beliefs, you can start to heal relationships with yourself, others, and your circumstances. I'm Ritika Rose, life coach, author, and speaker. My mission is to help you align with your most powerful, authentic self and transform how you experience your inner and outer world. Find the confidence and peace to live the highest version of your life. Visit RitikaRose.com.
Life can be demanding, but sometimes our wheels are spinning and we're too focused on making them turn to notice we're stuck in the mud. Tune into The Pause with me, Ellen Wyoming Deloy, every second and fourth Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific on Transformation Talk Radio. Learn how to stop, reflect, and start moving forward with intention. And if you're really looking to jumpstart your personal development, schedule a free coaching consultation with me at ellenwyomingdeloy.com. Tune in to the Be Happy Now show with me, Claudia Sam. Flex your soul connection muscle and be your inner guide to fulfillment. Every Thursday on TransformationTalkRadio.com. You are here for a bigger reason and are worthy of accessing it. Experience happiness now. Tune in to your intuition and connect with me. Visit ClaudiaSamCoaching.com.
Want to ignite your best life full of joy, passion, and purpose? Then join me, Stephanie James, for The Spark, Wednesday night, 6 o'clock Pacific Time, 9 o'clock Eastern, on TransformationTalkRadio.com, and learn how together we can illuminate the world. Learn more on StephanieJames.world. The best is yet to come.
Tune into Hungry for Answers every first and third Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com with me, Robin Clare. I am a recovery coach, professional, and best-selling author, bringing you eye-opening conversations about addiction and groundbreaking tools for recovery. To learn about me and my offering, visit Clarity.com. That's Claire, C-L-A-R-E, dash I-T-Y.com.
Welcome back. In today's show, we're talking about Kundalini yoga, just based on my experience and how it's really helped me tremendously in terms of quieting my very busy and overactive mind and helping me to understand myself and how I deal with challenges and resistance and, you know, bringing things up that maybe were like slightly hidden or I wasn't making the connection to, because when we have hang-ups, and they are sitting at our subconscious level, we're not really in a position to work through them because we just aren't aware of them. So Kundalini is this yoga of awareness, which I love, because once we know what's going on, then we're in a position to fix it. So I talked a little bit about like how movement is different in Kundalini. It's not necessarily going through like a yoga flow, like a sun salutation. And a lot of the movement is very repetitive. We will do, for example, some twisting actions for maybe 1 to 3 minutes, or like a windmill type of action where we're standing up and, you know, touching our left hand to our right toe and coming back up and going down the other side. And we will do this for 1 to 3 minutes. And why? Well, first off, your body is very dense, and it takes the body systems and the muscular systems a little while to figure out, hey, what are we doing here? What are we loosening up? What are we stretching? What are we activating? What gland or organ are we stimulating? And by just like touching our toes once and then coming back up, our body hasn't really processed what we're supposed to be doing down there touching our toes. So part of this awareness is helping the body become aware of what we want it to do. And it does take some time in order to do that. So we will do these repetitive motions that if it's not explained to you and you just show up to a class and like for 3 minutes you're, you know, making this twisting motion and you feel like a helicopter with your arms and you're like, well, you know, why am I doing this? Why are we here so long? If you get the method behind the madness, it makes sense and you can stop worrying about it from the ego perspective and start paying attention to what your body is doing. All right, so that is the significant difference around that movement piece, is that repetitive motion. The second is breath work and pranayama. We use a lot of breath of fire, which is the abdominal breathing, pushing the breath out of the diaphragm and letting the air flow back in, and more of a passive way. We do a lot of breath of fire, but we do alternate nostril breathing. We also do a cannon breath, which is like a, through an O-shaped mouth, and it's like a really fast in and out through the mouth. And sometimes these different pranayamas make you feel a little bit lightheaded. And the goal is definitely to do more of the breath work from the diaphragm. But if you look into the efficacy of breath work, it's actually become a very popular standalone therapeutic practice. And the pranayama can help us move stuck emotions, stuck energy out of our body. It can help people bring up like traumas that need to be released. And so there's actually like Breathworks or something like that. I can't remember the name, but there's several different schools that you can actually go to and get certified in just these pranayama breathwork techniques that actually have healing properties and help people work through their crap. So in Kundalini yoga, the breath is infused in a lot of the movement that we do. So we might be doing a repetitive movement, but also doing the cannon breath with it. Or we have our arms extended up at 45 degree angles, and we are doing breath of fire holding our arms up. So we are pairing movement with that breath work to help cleanse the system. And I found that the breath work for me really helps with that mind chatter. Like shoulder shrugs, if I can do shoulder shrugs and then do a breath of fire afterwards, my mind is quiet. It's still, like, it takes all of that gunk out and just moves it to the side. And so the breathing and the combination of movement and breath work is huge in Kundalini because it gets our body to work a little more efficiently because we're using the breath as well. Now, mantra, we have a lot of chanting. Sometimes it's just seed sounds like om, lam, hum, things like that, which correspond often to our different chakras. But, you know, these seed sounds create a vibration through the body. So if it's a seed sound, or it's just like a chant, like we open with Om Namo Gurudev Namo, and it's like a opening chant that just means, you know, I honor the wisdom within myself, the teacher within, and the teachers that have come before me. So the chants do have somewhat of a meaning to them, but it's actually the sound that is most crucial in the practice, because when you make a sound like Om, you are hitting the roof of your mouth with your tongue, and we do have pressure points on the roof of our mouth. Or if you're chanting something like Om, simple O-M, which is really like A-U-M, you can actually feel the vibration Om moving from down in your sacral chakra, like the lower chakras, up through your body, because you get to that part, and now you're vibrating in your chest and your throat. So that sound actually vibrates our cells. And when our cells vibrate, it's a healing process. If you think about the impact of sound on like a glass of water, you know, like you fill a glass of water and you move your finger around the rim of the glass, the water starts to vibrate, and our body is made up of water. And these vibrations can have a very therapeutic effect on us at a cellular level. So when we say Om Namo or Guru Wahe Guru, and we're hitting the roof of our mouth, we're stimulating those nadis, those pressure points, while also providing healing benefits for the cells in our body. So every chant has a particular purpose with it. And sometimes we chant in a meditative form. Sometimes it's just, you know, chanting alone to signify the opening and closing of class. And there's even one chant, it's a mantra, like meditation infused, called the Kirtan Kriya, that has been used in studies at UCLA in California with Alzheimer's patients. And there's finger movements, too, that go with it. So between the vibrational chanting and stimulating the acupressure points of the fingers, it's actually been shown to help Alzheimer's and memory loss patients with memory acquisition or retaining the memory that they have. So there is a science behind the chanting, the breath work, the mudras, which are the finger positions and the acupressure points that we are stimulating. There's a science behind it that has therapeutic a therapeutic impact on the physical body. So when you go to a class and people are chanting and you're like, well, this is kind of weird, if you understand that there is a science here and it's more about the sounds than the meaning, then it makes it a lot easier to try it out, to be okay with trying out. People have a fear of chanting something that, like, they think has bad words, but or like words that don't resonate them. Oh, if I'm chanting, I'm chanting to someone else's God. Well, first off, you don't even know what you're saying anyway, so it doesn't matter. It's not like, you know, you have knowing of what you're saying. It's meaningless. It's like making up a word and using it. It's meaningless. It doesn't matter. But secondly, none of these Kundalini chants are of a religious nature or are like trying to put evil thoughts into your head. I think that's, you know, a little bit paranoid when you go to yoga classes that use mantra. Oh, they're putting negative thoughts in my head. I don't know. I guess it's the same people that have conspiracy theories about everything. That's not how it is. And they're not chanting to like a god in particular, or it's not really religious. It's usually sounds, or it has a meaning such as like I'm connecting to the divine teacher within, Wahe Guru, like an expression of joy. It's something just, you know, stimulating creativity, intuition. It's nothing about any kind of religious beliefs or sayings. So even if you don't know what they're saying, don't be afraid to, you know, really chant along and just feel the sounds. Just pay attention to what that is doing in your body, okay? That is most important, more important than anything else. And then, of course, meditation. A lot of times in Kundalini, like the meditation, the mantra, the mudras with the hands, and even sometimes movement, sometimes you're doing all of them at once. Because even in asana practice or going through the motions, we want to have a meditative mind, right? So a lot of times we're doing all of these things at once. It's like all incorporated into one sequence. Sometimes it is separate where we just have a meditation where we're focused on the third eye or whatnot. So this is why I found Kundalini to be so helpful. It incorporates all of these things. It helps us become super aware of what's going on in our body, what is helping us with what is creating roadblocks for us. And it sometimes brings up stuff that we're ready to release and let go. I found this form of yoga to work a lot quicker than other forms of yoga in terms of this kind of thing. So if you haven't tried Kundalini, go try it. See if it resonates. It may not, but just try it. Allow yourself to experience something new. And don't let scandals and stuff get you hung up. If you want to do the research, go Google it. You can learn all about it. But it's not about that. It's not about one person. It is yoga that has been around for a very long time and helps us with a lot of different things. So thank you for joining me, for listening. I will see you next time here on Coffee with the Universe on Transformation Talk Radio every third Tuesday of the month at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank you for joining me for Coffee with the Universe. Make sure to tune in next time as I continue to share tips and tricks to help you stop waking up anxious, uninspired, and energetically drained in the morning and feel calm, connected to your higher self, and confident instead. If you would like more information on my morning magic course, please visit www.kknw.org.